This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey everyone, I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
Hi, I'm Gemma Jones. I'm an improvement coach based in the UK and working with people across the world.
Well, folks, we have a dear guest, a friend of the Baptist Management System and Baptist Memorial Healthcare that we've known for a long time, Mark Rosenthal. And we're going to have a great conversation today around leadership as a process. But before we jump into that, I tend to assume sometimes that, well, everybody knows Mark. But just in case, if they don't, Mark, would you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your background?
Let's see. I'll give you the continuous improvement history as I got really introduced to it formally, like way back in 1989. And I joke working for a little airplane company in Seattle. And through my time there at Boeing and then really ratcheting it up as I went to another company called Genie Industries and 10 tons of exposure there, especially to the Japanese consultants that we had there at and at Boeing, got recruited out of there to be a lean director at Kodak. My old boss keeps calling me from what is now Terex. Eventually, I hop back over there. I've been doing this as an independent consultant full-time since 2011. And, you know, that's kind of where my history with Baptist begins is a couple of years into that. See, I always think in terms of how many Katacons have gone by. And I think I first met Skip at Katacon 1. So, you know, we just finished 11. So there we are. So that's kind of a little bit about my background. You'll hear a lot about Toyota Kata in my conversation. I was probably an early adopter of that. And I've known Mike Rother, who wrote the book, since 2010. So I'm fairly well known in that community as well.
Fantastic, Mark. And I've really enjoyed your blog. And we'll get you to tell us about that later. But I know just talking to you, Mark, you've been doing a lot of thinking and having meaningful conversations with folks around leadership as a process. Tell us some of your initial thoughts. What's been going on there around those?
Yeah, well, you know, if you listen to I call the continuous improvement change agents, right, which are folks like us, folks like you, Skip, the people who are embedded in the organization and often the technical people like me who come in from outside. And a very common complaint is, how do I get them, whoever them is, to buy in to the change we're making? And, you know, the answer, pat answer for a long time has been, well, you can't. And I started thinking, okay, well, what if we could? And really then, what is it that we could do that might leverage the skills that these CI folks, continuous improvement folks, already have and improve their ability to influence the organization? And we've got to do that by looking at leadership as a process. And if it's a process, that process can be studied and that process can be improved. This gets a little meta because we're working on two things at the same time, you know, improving the way the organization is led, you know, affecting change within the stakeholders. But the most important bit is improving the way I go about leading that change. So I'm looking at it as kind of a simultaneous two-track improvement process. So that's kind of how I got started on this. And really got me going was when I was introduced. I read the book about adaptive leadership by Ron Heifetz and Minsky and then others. And what I saw was observe and then make a decision and then run an intervention as an experiment. Okay, well, ding, ding, ding. That sounded pretty familiar from the Kata pattern. Grasp the current condition, establish a target, run experiments to see if the change you're proposing is actually getting traction or not. The only difference really is the context. So the process of leadership at a high level is PDCA. or PDSA, I know, Skip, as you like to say. And once I think I understood that, then it was a matter of figuring out, okay, how can we teach people to go through those steps, go through the improvement kata steps of understand the challenge, grasp the current condition, establish target condition, run experiments against obstacles, on the process of leadership within myself, and then the impact that I'm having on the rest of the organization. So that's kind of the short version, or long short version, of how I got into this.
So Mark, when you think about this, what kind of leaders are you thinking about? I think of all the different layers of leadership within an organization. Where is your mind going straight away?
Well, the short answer is to whoever they is.
Yeah.
But I think the key here is the insight that I had when I started looking at the adaptive leadership model is the difference between technical challenges and adaptive challenges. And the technical challenges, the technical aspects of putting in the right process of getting one by one flow going, even the technical process of standing up a kata storyboard and getting people to, you know, follow the script that's something I can outsource, right? I can hire somebody else to set that up for me. But the adaptive change has to be made by the stakeholders themselves. And often those adaptive changes challenge the norms of the organization, and sometimes even the implicit tacit values of the organization. So we've got to learn how to deal with those adaptive issues, not just the technical ones. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And it's making me think as well about how so much of leadership is about people and relationships.
Yeah.
And so I'm guessing if, you know, we're thinking about it as a process, and, you know, in Kata, we will document that process. We will draw block diagrams. We will look at metrics, and we'll look at data. And I wonder if at this point some people might say, yeah, but so much of the process is invisible, we can't see it. It's going on in our heads or in our hearts, or, you know, how we feel about things. So what's your kind of response to that?
We can say the same thing about the production processes. They're in people's heads. That's how they feel. But what we asked them to do was start understanding what's actually happening and start writing down your next step as an experiment. So, you know, for people who have been in the kata world for a long time, that's not that big a leap. And so, I'm just going to share that at our Kata School Cascadia July event, we ran a very experimental leadership track with a dozen folks that we tried a lot of these things out on them. And it seems to still be getting traction. We're still meeting every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific to debrief what they're learning. So it seems to be working. I know there's a lot of work to do, but, it was a first pass. It was pretty cool. But, I think a lot of it, just to continue and interrupt me if I go off on a tangent, if you want to ask a question. But part of it is just really breaking down what leadership itself is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not telling people what to do, right? That's compliance, but it's not leadership. Leadership happens in the mind of the person being led, not in the mind of the leader, because that is the person who has to make a choice to listen to you and to choose to enroll in whatever vision that you are trying to get them to come along with you on. So we're talking now about intrinsic motivation rather than extrinsic motivation, which is, whenever we're asking, well, what's in it for them? We're looking at extrinsic motivation. We're looking at a transaction, and that's not leadership. That's gaining compliance.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first step, Gemma, is exactly it. We've got to understand that this is a social process, not just one with authority.
It just made me think that I think a lot of people could go to this as being very technical. But like you say, there's also this social layer, as we talk about so much at Baptist.
Yeah, And that's it, right? That's how change propagates through an organization, right? It propagates through social connections, not via the org chart. And we've just, as we're looking to change things, we have to acknowledge some of those truths.
Yeah, Mark, I'm really intrigued by this. And thank you for joining us for this dialogue today. The intrinsic motivation. Yeah. I'm wondering if, you know, by the people being led, you said, so this is really intrinsic to them.
Yeah.
Will you unpack that a little bit more?
You know, actually, yes. And I'm going to refer to a whole body of psychology called self-determination theory, which was developed by Richard Ryan and Edward Deci, if I'm not mistaken. They've gotten their names, Ryan and Deci, I know, at the University of Rochester. And that came out, they started researching what is intrinsic motivation. And one of the things they have boiled this down to is there's some fundamental experiences that people crave, the sensation of relatedness, of belonging to something bigger, the sensation of autonomy, and the sensation of competence. And they're basically saying that if an activity is giving people a big boost in, you know, some of those things, it's something they're going to do on their own. On the other hand, if the activity is threatening any of those things, they're going to find a way to get those experiences anyway. It may not be the way you'd like them to. So being conscious of what causes people to be intrinsically motivated. I mean, who is it that coaches their kids' baseball team, right? They don't do that for the money. And they're taking a great deal of initiative and they're building their competence and they're part of an organization they like being a part of. And that's where they're getting the juice from. And they'll do that as long as they can. So it's being conscious of those things. And as we're talking to people, really asking ourselves deliberately, which way am I moving the needle on these experiences and being deliberate about it?
Yeah, I like that. So there's belief in belonging, which I think that we've covered in several of our podcast episodes, and I think there's a lot of power there. But you threw me a curveball there with two others, with autonomy,
yeah,
and competence.
Yeah.
And so, and again, I don't really always think of those three things going together, but I really like that in self-determination theory.
Yeah.
So the autonomy to be able to kind of be the expert, if you will, or have some knowledge, some residual knowledge in the space to be able to do work that you're tasked to do.
Right. Yeah. And it's really, I think, down to the, is this what I'm being asked to do? Is it congruent with my internal values, or am I creating conflict by doing it in myself, which means I'm kind of having to force myself? And so where is that motivation coming from? Is it by my own volition, or is it because some external force is, you know, forcing me to comply? And there's a sliding scale of that. I think Dan Pink in his book Drive retranslates it to, I got to get it right, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. But they're fundamentally just re-expressions of similar concepts.
Very good.
So let's imagine, Mark, yeah, I'm a leader. And I, you know, I want to take some of these concepts. Where would I start with this?
Thank you. So step one, right? Relation, building relatedness and trust. And I'm using relatedness deliberately because that comes out of that self-determination theory. And I love the expression out of motivational interviewing, which is a process for psychotherapy based on Carl Rogers' work. But there, basic first step for establishing relationship is, can we walk together? And if I don't have a yeah from that alone, I probably have an uphill battle getting them to hear me. Mm-hmm. And then the other part then right with that is, a lot of us, me included, right, have, you know, these multi-hour courses on this is what you got to do. And we push to talk, right? And like an FM radio, you either push to talk or release to listen, but you can't do both at the same time, right? And we get this megaphone out. But if you're not being heard, the first step is not to turn up the volume. It's to shut up and listen and start pulling out by engaging listening, by active listening. It's kind of trite, but I'm calling it engaging listening, of really just making sure that you understand what they're trying to say, to the point where you're kind of paraphrasing it back and they're agreeing that what they heard from you is what they're trying to tell you. And you'll usually get either a correction, which is what you want, more information, or you'll get elaboration. And both of those are really grasping the current condition of where this human being that I'm talking to, where they're at, what's troubling them, what's important to them. And then we've got an opening for what we might be able to do that would help them solve their problems rather than asking them to solve ours by doing something our way.
Mm-hmm. So let's say we've got, you know, a hospital with a thousand people in, or a factory with hundreds of people in, you know, because you're going to get different responses from different people.
Yeah.
So how do you work with that as a leader? Like, who do you go talk to and who do you listen to?
Yeah, everybody, really, because what I'm trying to do, right, is put together a mental chart. And we actually ask people in the class to build a sociogram, which is kind of the social equivalent of a block diagram. Who influences who? Where are the solid connections? Where are the conflicts within the organization? And build a picture of the social network as best I can, so that when I'm trying to figure out where my leverage points are, where I have people who are potential allies, or I have people who are more ambivalent about the change we're proposing, I've got a sense of who they are, and I have a sense of who they listen to. So that's all part of grasping that current condition, and I can do that formally, or I can, you know, like here just in the next room, I have just spent a couple of days just listening to the meetings and watching the dynamics within the meeting, and I built a pretty good picture of, you know, who felt like they weren't being heard, who might have been dominating the airtime, and then I can start doing those small interventions and, you know, take that 47-minute meeting down to, I think today it was 12.
Hey, Mark, we talked some about the kind of, you know, you've got champions for your calls, you have like fence sitters, and you've got some detractors, and you kind of always have, is the, your sociogram, is it similar as to how you're kind of putting folks in, putting folks in buckets for that social block diagram?
I don't really want to put them in buckets, because that's, I don't know that the word, I'm not sure that's respectful, because they all have their reasons that are deeply personal for responding the way they do. But if I took that and layered it onto Everett Rogers' model for change diffusion, right, where you've got the early adopters, you've got the early majority, the late majority. Yep. And, you know, it's common to call those people on the far right tail laggards. And I prefer to call them skeptics, or the people who are more ambivalent. But if you were to then look at who those people are socially connected to, then you've got a potential opportunity, because you want to engage the people on the left, right? The people who are more likely to be get seeking information on new ways from outside. And they have friends who are further to the right, who have friends who are further to the right. And what I'm trying to do is just allow the social connections to propagate naturally through there. Because that guy who's the skeptic, because it's been working for him for decades, you know, who am I to come in and tell him he's got to do his job differently? But if his friends are saying it, it's a whole different ball game. And when I started looking at that, you know, this is going to get kind of geeky on you, but that process looks an awful lot like a biological neural network, right? I have to say, it's weird, we have to say biological now, because I'm not talking about a computer neural network. I'm talking about what's between our ears, where, you know, you've got a neuron that activates when the ones upstream of it, enough of them activate, and there's enough inhibitors that don't activate, and then it says, I'm on board, and it activates, and it does the same thing downstream. That social network looks an awful lot like that. So my mental model here is it's really looking at that, you know, that change threshold that everybody has when enough people around them are thinking and talking about a new way, they'll begin to listen because they trust and know those folks. It's messy because I can't say I'm going to roll out this training by organization and do all of that and really expect that to work that well, because I'm thinking that it doesn't matter how you roll it out, it's going to propagate through the social network anyway. So let's just acknowledge that and let's turn up the contrast and do it. Just use that.
I guess some of this is going to depend on the local.
Oh, yeah.
Culture and the, you know, the dynamics and the kind of the power dynamics within the organization.
Bingo.
What have you observed about that, Mark?
So that's the beauty of taking that time to what Ron Heifetz describes as getting on the balcony, grasping the current condition, and just understanding what those dynamics actually are. And now it's right. It depends on what the situation actually is. I found one of our participants was been kind of trying to convince somebody who was hard to convince, but he realized that he's got allies, that this other person he's trying to, stakeholder he's trying to convince, actually listen to. And so he did, you know, we kind of joked about it being a bank shot, right? He gets them on board as allies, and then they can kind of collectively, you know, meet with the guy and say, hey, think we need to maybe make some adjustments to how we're doing this. So it's being conscious of those dynamics. I can't fight them, but I have to understand them. And then I have to figure out how to use them to my, I don't want to sound manipulative, because that's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is build a coalition of the willing that then can be used to engage other people. And that's really what I'm trying to do here.
Yeah, Mark, and I appreciate your sensitivity to some of those words. And I'm just sitting, you know, we've spent a lot of time on this sociogram, this kind of building a social network. I think it's very powerful. It can also be very sensitive, because this could come across in a negative way. How do you avoid that?
Transparency,
yeah,
I think, is really the only thing you can do. But, and the other part, though, is, you know, this isn't quite answering your question, Brad, but, you know, what we had them do is build it and then say, okay, where are you on here? And because now you're on the dance floor, right? You are part of those dynamics. And we just, as part of grasping your current condition, right? What's your history with those dynamics? What have maybe you done in the past that actually contributed to some of the stuff that is maybe holding you back now? So there was a lot of introspection involved, because it's not just changing the way the organization is led. It's changing the way I engage to enroll people in that change. And I've got to look in the mirror first with a long, hard look at what's my target condition and what fears do I have to overcome in order to engage, in order to fully engage, rather than to pull back or bore in, which is typically what we do that's ineffective. We either pull back or bore in. I'm a bore in guy, and I've learned to not do that.
Hey, Mark, something else that, you know, this conversation kind of conjures up. I know you're familiar with kind of Baptists and our work with Dr. Shine and Humble Inquiry. Some of the work out of that, we spent some time and had some experimentation with some of our leaders on relationship mapping and the power of doing that. And is this sociogram similar to kind of a relationship map?
It is a relationship map. And the only thing that I'm saying is, let's simplify a little bit. I'm not trying to do a, anthropological study. I'm just trying to get a taste of what are the dynamics that I'm actually seeing, so I can maybe by drawing it better understand it. I would hesitate to try to map a huge organization like Baptist all at once, because that doesn't really help. But within the domain of, you know, what's as a change agent, what's my challenge, right? What is the one dynamic right now that I'm working to change in some way within the organization? And then from a personal standpoint, what am I challenging in myself to be more effective at that? So I might be drawing that sociogram maybe for, you know, a leader and his direct reports and maybe theirs, but I don't think it's necessary to draw the whole thing at once. Now, what level? Any level. I could do the same thing with a manager and his supervisors and their folks as I can with a CEO and his direct reports.
Really good, Mark. Let me just make a little plug for any listeners. You know, you've heard Mark use the phrase sociogram. And if anyone has an interest in seeing what we're calling a relationship map, you could go to the Baptist Management System. It's that simple. Baptist Management System YouTube channel, and there's a little 20-minute video on there.
Oh, cool, I might take that.
and long as you have a blank sheet of paper, you've got everything you need. Now, yeah. I am going to quote my friend Mark for a phrase I stole from you many, many years ago, because it goes along with this relationship map. And if there's one phrase I will always remember you saying, Mark, it's that ink makes you think.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the power of the relationship map, is I'm sitting down and I'm drawing out these immediate relationships I have.
Exactly.
Some people that report to me, some people that don't. Maybe they're vendors, whoever it may be. And we happen to use the Humble Inquiry scaling system. And every time I've done that, the very first time I ever did it, I did it with Dr. Edgar Schein. And I was surprised that a relationship I had with a person on that map was significantly worse than I thought it was.
Yeah.
And hey, Skip, I also want to give a plug. Mark, it's important that you know that Skip says ink makes you think all the time. And he always gives you credit.
Well, so, I have to credit a guy named Jim Sorensen, who I heard it from in 1995. So I'm just going to, you know, shout out to him if he's listening ever. But it's,
well,
yeah,
we need to make sure he hears it. And then, Mark, yeah, we want you to know that we give you credit every time we say that a Baptist. And it's true, Skip. I mean, you know, you were talking about it. I mean, you learn new things and see it in a different way when you write it down. It engages a different part of your brain, and it allows us to kind of look at it in a different way. And so I think it's a great exercise.
And drawing a picture engages a yet different part of the brain. And then you've got now spatial and, you know, spatial and verbal all kind of interconnecting. So, yeah, if you're running into trouble getting to your targets, let's go back to grasp the current condition, because that's probably where we have come up short. And anytime I hit an I don't know, let's go back and understand. So like in that sociogram is still a hypothesis because it all came out of you. Now, and I got important things to understand. Now, my first experiment may well be to just go engage in people in conversation and listen to them. Hey, it seems like you've got, some good supporters here, but maybe a little bit of conflict with Joe over there, and then shut up. Because they'll say, oh, no, we're really good friends. We just like to argue. That's valuable information. Or, yeah, I can't stand the guy. Or, yeah, we've got this. You know, what kind of relationship do they have? And if it's important for me to understand that, it's important enough for me to check it out in order to test my hypothesis about what those dynamics actually are.
Yeah. You know, another thing that it makes me think of, Gemma, just some conversations we've had before, is it's natural, doesn't make it right, but it is very natural for our thinking to become linear. And we tend to want to say, well, listen, why can't everyone be like Jane Doe? But everyone's a unique individual. And even though there are times when we applaud everyone being a unique individual and we say it and it's on all the banners, there's other times it frustrates us, right? And by creating that relationship map, it's making the invisible visible.
Yeah.
And it's giving us the reality check that there's lots of interdependence going on. And life is messy. And not everyone's going to be like Jane Doe. And you could even be tricky, because Jane Doe may not even be like you think she is, right?
And I want to just make sure that we're not losing sight of the forest here. I'm doing that, grasping the current condition, in the context of a challenge.
That's right. That's right.
So I've got, you know, two flavors of challenges too, but really I'm thinking in terms of what kind of, you know, culture. Let's look at Ed Schein's culture model, but let's just boil it down to the very simple thing, right? What defines culture is the way people talk to each other and the way groups of people talk to each other. Yeah. And everything else is kind of, in my mind, more study and more abstraction. But at the end of the day, I'm trying to shift the way people talk to each other. And I'm trying to change what they talk about. That's, if I'm doing culture change, that's what this is about. So my challenge as a change agent is typically to shift the nature of a conversation that happens or conversations that happen in the course of the way the day-to-day business is run. So I want to keep that in mind. And then when I'm looking at that sociogram, what I'm looking at is what are the inhibitors and what are the exciters for moving the conversation in that direction? And who is it that I really need to ideally identify that I can ask to try something? Because just skipping back down to target conditions and then experiments in the world of leadership, right? The experiment is you have to talk to somebody in order to learn or in order to reach an agreement with them to at least humor a request that you're making of some kind in order to try out a different way of doing things. Because if you don't do that, if you don't actually engage others, you're not leading. And so that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind as we go through this.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. I really like thinking about this whole leadership as a process. And because socio-technical systems are complex, they're messy. The mechanical system, in my mind, is so much easier.
Yeah.
You know, the parts fit where they need to fit and things, you know, work a certain way. But the socio-technical is messy. And humans are both beautiful and messy at the same time.
Yeah.
And so this has been really great, Mark. On behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much. We've enjoyed having a relationship with you for so long. And thank you so much for spending some time and helping us think how we think about this. And thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate you.
Cool. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.